From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Al-Shabaab gunmen kill 36 people in northeastern Kenya. A suggestion on how to kickstart the Iran nuclear talks.
The question of trying to establish leverage. The United States and the P5 plus one has enormous leverage, but it is choosing not to use it.
Obama announces steps on improving police practices and a possible makeover for the human heart. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The Somali militant group Al-Shabaab has claimed responsibility for killing 36 people early today in northeastern Kenya. The attack happened at a quarry near the town of Mandera, where witnesses say gunmen struck as workers were sleeping in their tents. An Al-Shabaab statement said its fighters had killed what they called Kenyan crusaders and was punishing Kenya for sending troops to fight in Somalia. The Kenyan forces have been in Somalia since 2011 as part of a multi-nation African force that has helped push Al-Shabaab out of Somalia's major cities. The militants have carried out periodic attacks in Kenya, warning the government that more will come unless it withdraws the troops. Last month, Al-Shabaab gunmen killed 28 people in the same region as today's killings. The New York Times reports a wave of attacks across northern Nigeria, including two Monday, involving the capitals of two states, shows the Islamist militant group Boko Haram remains able to strike at will in the region, especially against civilian targets. Monday's attacks on Maiduguri Market in Borno State and a police post in Damaturo in Yobe State killed at least five, perhaps as many as 16 people, and wounded scores more. Friday, an attack on the central mosque in the Muslim northern city of Kano left more than 100 people dead. Female suicide bombers killed dozens last week in Maiduguri. Thousands have died in Boko Haram's five-year insurgency to create an Islamic caliphate in areas it controls. The central government has come under criticism for an ineffective strategy to defeat Boko Haram. Terrorism expert Greg Barton of Australia's Monash University tells VOA's Victor Beatty, the army is beset by corruption and allegations of human rights abuses.
The Nigerian military is really in a shambolic state. It's suffering from, as indeed most institutions in Nigeria, from massive corruption, and its capacity to fight Boko Haram seems greatly diminished, and it may well be simply we're seeing Boko Haram respond to the opportunity. It may well be, to some extent, it's responding to more global circumstances. We still don't have any confirmation of official links with Al-Qaeda, but what's happening with both Jabhat al-Nusra and Islamic State appears to be having an inspirational effect across Africa from groups that are sympathetic. And in any case, circumstances make it possible for Boko Haram to respond in the way they have.
There are reports Nigeria has canceled U.S. training of its soldiers to fight against terror groups, apparently a sign of growing strains between the two countries. Why is that?
Nigeria, frankly, has an appalling human rights record, or the military particularly. In some respects, Boko Haram, which was formed in 2002, but which really took off this current campaign of violence in 2009, did so in part because of military brutality, and that's fed into the cycle of violence. Amnesty International and other institutions have been very critical of well-documented cases of human rights abuses. And the U.S. military basically has said, we know you need better equipment, but you can't get it until you have proper training. And if you don't play by our rules, you're not getting that training or the equipment that goes with it. And of course, Nigeria sees that as an affront to its dignity and is at this stage going off in a bit of a huff. But it really is in a bad place.
Cameroon's foreign minister on Monday said a five-country African coalition is soon to be operational to fight terrorists. It includes some 3,500 soldiers from Benin, Chad, Cameroon, Niger, and Nigeria. Is this a hopeful sign?
It is a hopeful sign. It's a classic case of the devil being in the details. It sounds like a good initiative, but it depends to what extent they can cross over international jurisdictions across between countries and work as a group. I mean, a multinational force moving together across national borders could be just the solution that's required, but it depends how good they are and how much political backup they're going to get from the governments involved. And in Nigeria's case, that's not clear at this stage. I mean, there's been so many claims made by the Nigerian government and military that have later been disproven that I think people greet this news with some skepticism.
Thousands have fled the violence in northeast Nigeria. Is that region of the country becoming uninhabitable, and what's the best counterinsurgency effort?
Well, it's not yet uninhabitable simply because Nigeria is a very large, very populous country, and it's true that perhaps 750,000 people have left those three northern states, and tens of thousands have actually left the country, but that leaves millions of people behind who have no place to go. But it is the case that Boko Haram seems increasingly to want to take control of territory, perhaps inspired by Islamic State's example. In any case, it's taken dozens of towns and villages. And until there's a sudden increase in capacity by the Nigerian military, there seems to be no answer to that.
Barden says a promising development is the emergence of a civilian militia, or vigilantes, to combat Boko Haram. He says if they can be a disciplined force that can work in parallel with the army, there is some hope the insurgency can be checked. The Muslim emir of Kano, Lamido Sanusi, has been outspoken in his criticism of the government's response to terrorism and urged citizens to defend themselves within the law. John Campbell, a New York-based senior fellow for Africa Policy Studies, says Friday's attack on Kano was not just a challenge to the secular state, but to the traditional Islamic establishment. He says the struggle in northern Nigeria can also be seen as a civil war within Islam. International powers and Iran have extended talks into 2015 on a comprehensive nuclear deal after failing for a second time this year to seal an agreement ending the standoff over Tehran's nuclear ambitions. State media quoted Iranian President Hassan Rouhani as saying Tehran will be the eventual winner of the negotiations, which now face a June 30th deadline. Diplomats said gaps remain on key issues, including the number of centrifuges Iran would be allowed to operate, as well as the levels of uranium enrichment it can undertake. We asked analyst Gabriel Scheinman, director of policy at the Jewish Policy Center in Washington, what is next?
What is next is unclear. The stalemate that resulted in this current extension, there's very little that is going to change over the next few months that would seem to be able to break that. The Iranian negotiators representing the regime have an interest in trying to basically slow down or at least roll back some of the American and international sanctions regime. And from the American side, the United States and the P5 plus one, its European allies, are interested in trying to roll back some of the Iranian nuclear progress. But until you find some sort of Venn diagram of agreement, it's not going to go anywhere. So there really isn't much that will change over the next few months.
So what should be done to improve the situation?
Well, the just like any negotiations, whether it's going into an Iranian bazaar, sort of the treasure trove of housewares in the market, or something as important as this, it's a question of trying to establish leverage. The United States and the P5 plus one has enormous leverage, but it is choosing not to use it. And so the question is, can over the next few months the international community try and reestablish or reinvigorate some of the leverage? And some of that has to do on the economic side. The sanctions regime that has been put in place over the course of many years has been relaxed, and as a consequence, the Iranian economy, after being in recession for consecutive years, is growing again. So what can you do on the economic front, whether that is new sanctions, or we've seen the price of oil drop dramatically over the last few months to a five-year low, whether those things will be able to put increased economic leverage on the Iranian regime to be able to want to reach an accommodation. And the second part of that is military leverage. Now, that doesn't mean going to war or doing anything of that sort, but the president and the administration has basically taken the military option off the table. And because of the nature of the negotiations, have effectively boxed in Israel and Saudi Arabia and other American allies in the region to taking their military option off the table. And that dual effect has it so that the Iranian regime can relax in such a way that it doesn't feel that its livelihood is at stake in the same way in these negotiations.
Meanwhile, Iran says it is not stopping its nuclear operations.
It's not required to. I mean, part of the interim, and by interim we're now going, but you got to July, it's a nearly two-year interim deal. But in the interim deal, the agreement reached doesn't require Iran to stop most of its nuclear program. It basically requires it to slow down some of its forward progress in some parts of it. And so even over the next 6 months, and the extension that was agreed to is basically on terms virtually identical to what's happened over the last year and a half, those added conditions weren't put in place.
This is very concerning to Israel. How long do you think they'll wait until they act unilaterally?
Well, that's the million-dollar question. I certainly wouldn't venture to try and predict the future, but the Israelis do have a long history, whether it was in Iraq in 1981 or in Syria in 2007, or covertly to try and stop or preempt nuclear programs from getting too far down the road. But even if even if the negotiations break down or there's these rolling extensions that could continue ad infinitum, my hunch is that it'll be longer than it'll be further into the future than we think if the Israelis were to take overt unilateral military action. There's a long way to go between the Iranians being able to have a breakout capacity, i.e., the enough enriched uranium at a high enough level to be able to have the capacity to make a bomb versus having the capability to miniaturize it, develop an appropriate explosive trigger device, put it on intercontinental ballistic missile to be able to target Israel and others. So there's a long range of possibility for when Israel might act. The question just becomes, what are the cost-benefit analysis? Are there better times in terms of international diplomacy for it to act? Are there better times from a military perspective? Are there better times from a domestic political perspective? And all those factor into play for when Israel might do something if it does something.
Gabriel Scheinman, Director of Policy at the Jewish Policy Center in Washington. The P5+1 talks, which include representatives of Russia, China, the United States, Britain, France, and Germany, are aimed at ensuring that Iran is not developing nuclear weapons. With a satisfactory deal in place, the West would then lift sanctions. Iran insists its nuclear program is solely for peaceful civilian purposes, such as medical research and generating power. U.S. President Barack Obama has announced steps to improve trust between the police and the communities they serve. Mr. Obama revealed his plan late Monday after a meeting with civil rights leaders, law enforcement officials, academics, and others. Protests are still taking place in some American cities following last week's decision by a grand jury not to indict the white policeman who killed an unarmed black teenager in Ferguson, Missouri. Zlatika Hoke has this report for VOA Television.
President Obama said he was struck by the stories of discrimination coming from young people who participated in the discussion Monday.
When I hear the young people around this table talk about their experiences, it violates my belief in what America can be.
Mr. Obama said in a country that values equality under the law, it is not acceptable to have so many people of color feel that they're treated unfairly.
When any part of the American family does not feel like it is being treated fairly, that's a problem for all of us. It's not just a problem for some. It's not just a problem for a particular community or a particular demographic. It means that we are not as strong as a country as we can be.
President Obama also acknowledged the difficulties that law enforcement officers face at work. But he said the differences between the police and communities of color are not irreconcilable.
In fact, I'm convinced that if we work hard, that we can make sure that police officers and the communities they serve are partners in battling crime, partners in making sure everybody feels safe, that we can build confidence and we can build trust, but it's not going to happen overnight.
He said in order to advance that goal, law enforcement will establish a list of best practices that must be institutionalized on the federal, state, and local levels around the country. One of the key issues discussed was the military-grade arms used by riot police during the protests in Ferguson.
I will be signing an executive order that specifies how we are going to make sure that that program is accountable, how we're going to make sure that that program is transparent, and how are we going to make sure that we're not building a militarized culture inside our local law enforcement.
The president said he will propose several initiatives for police reform, equipment, and training. A $263 million budget request will include the purchase of 50,000 lapel cameras for police officers. Rights activists said the meeting was important, but that the action should not stop there.
We live in a country that we must support law enforcement, but law enforcement must support justice. The ruling in Ferguson is something that is not a wake-up call for many of us that's been woke a long time. It's a reminder to the nation to live up to the principles. And I think the president gathering all of us and young leaders today was historic, but it should not be an isolated incident.
President Obama said he is deeply invested in following through on this issue because the experience of some young Americans violate his belief in what America can be. Zlatica Hoke, VOA News, Washington.
The Ebola epidemic is having a stark economic impact on Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea, and is cutting economic growth even more than estimates published in early November. That's the conclusion of a study released today by the World Bank. Before the Ebola crisis, all three nations were growing strongly. Liberia is now expected to grow at just 2.2% annual rate, and Sierra Leone predicted to expand 4%, which is around one-third of the pre-crisis rates of expansion for these two nations. Guinea's growth projection has been cut from 4.5% before the crisis to just half of 1% now. The economic impact of disease and death has been amplified by workers and shoppers staying home to avoid contagion. The economy also is hurt by reductions in trade, travel, and the loss of foreign experts in mining and other industries. The impact of Ebola will continue to be felt as rising expenses for health care and falling tax revenue strain national budgets and force governments to move money from infrastructure projects to emergency medical activities. Hey, the human heart could be getting a makeover. 3D printing is now being used, not to make a new heart, but to make a model that matches the heart in every way. As VOA's Roseanne Skirbel explains, the new technology can help surgeons better assess patients before an operation.
Surgeons routinely use digital images to explore the heart in minute detail, but no two human hearts are alike, which led Matthew Bramlett to create an exact heart replica from those images. The University of Illinois College of Medicine pediatric cardiologist says the 3D replica uncovers information to guide surgery. Here's how it works. A CT scan, MRI, and other data are sent to a 3D printer to replicate a heart in a plaster or ceramic mold. The printer then constructs the heart thin layer by thin layer. Bramlett says the model matches the real heart in every detail. Bramlett has built model hearts for various procedures, all with successful outcomes. In one case, digital images showed a tiny hole in a baby's heart. Yet the 3D printed model revealed multiple holes, defects the baby was born with, and not readily apparent in the images. Bramla came to a recent American Heart Association meeting with a prop, a 3D printed baby's heart. Kathy Magliotto is a cardiac surgeon at St. John's Health Center in Los Angeles. Speaking by Skype, she said she welcomes the 3D model, saying it can help surgeons make better decisions before they operate.
The fact that I can then take this very complicated structure which has just an endless possibilities of what it could look like anatomically when I open the body, and you give it to me before the operation, that I can hold it in my hand and plan an operation around what I'm seeing, touching, and feeling, that to me is what can potentially change the game on an operation and save lives.
Matthew Bramlett continues to explore the technology. He's partnered with the National Institutes of Health to build a 3D reference library that includes models and images that others can learn from. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yockey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On December 2nd, 1804, Napoleon Bonaparte was crowned France's first emperor since Charlemagne at Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris. To show that the Roman Catholic Church was not his overlord, Napoleon was handed the crown by Pope Pius VII, but he placed it on his own head. On this day in 1823, U.S. President James Monroe proclaimed the Monroe Doctrine. The doctrine stated that the United States would not interfere in European wars or internal affairs, but it also expected Europe to refrain from further colonization in the Western Hemisphere. In 1859, radical U.S. abolitionist John Brown was hanged for his deadly raid on Harper's Ferry. In 1908, Emperor Pu Yi, often referred to as the last emperor, ascended to the Chinese throne. He was only 2 years of age. On this day in 1942, working at the University of Chicago, Italian-born Nobel Prize-winning physicist Enrico Fermi directed the first controlled nuclear chain reaction in history. Fermi's work was part of the Manhattan Project, a secret U.S. wartime project to develop nuclear weapons. In 1947, riots broke out in Jerusalem in response to the approval on November 29th of the UN Partition Plan. The plan would end British rule over the area and divide the land between two independent states, one Jewish and the other Arab. Arabs rejected the plan and it was never fully implemented. In 1954, the U.S. and the Republic of China, Taiwan, signed a mutual defense treaty. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
With the assistance of U.S. and partner nation airstrikes, Iraqi security forces, including Kurdish forces, have curtailed the advance of ISIL in Iraq and have reclaimed some territory threatened or captured by the terrorist group. But forces in Iraq fighting ISIL need more and urgent help to defeat it. President Barack Obama has authorized an additional 1,500 U.S. military advisors to be sent to Iraq to bolster Iraqi capacity and capability. And the Pentagon has requested that the U.S. Congress approve an additional $1.6 billion package of security assistance to Iraqi security forces as part of President Obama's $5.6 billion Overseas Contingency Operations Fund to degrade and defeat ISIL. In briefing reporters, State Department Press Office Director Jeff Rathke said the U.S. is committed to helping the Iraqi security forces, including the Kurdish security forces, achieve victory over ISIL.
We have enormous respect for the courage that the Kurds have shown and the fight that they've already taken to ISIL. And that's why, in coordination with the government of Iraq, the United States and the coalition have been very supportive of Iraqi Kurdish forces.
Since the crisis began, the United States and members of the coalition have worked with the Iraqi central government to send 46 plane loads of needed equipment to the Kurdish regional government, Mr. Rathke said. And we continue our support.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237 USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.